Live from New York, it's Saturday night.
Or live from Phoenix, from the Outchain Community Studios, it's Bickley and Marotta. Doesn't have the same cachet, I understand. It's a Friday edition of the show. Diamondbacks getting ready to start a 9-game road trip tonight in New York against the Mets. The D-backs have not been playing great baseball. They went 1-6 on their recent homestand. They're not hitting at all. Everybody's seemingly in a slump. But what I like about this team, they don't let it affect them, at least outwardly. Now, yeah. I'm sure this was in the works for a really long time, regardless of how good things are or how bad things are. But they have these themed road trips now.
Yeah.
Where they wear different kinds of outfits on the on flights out of town.
Right.
So when the Diamondbacks left for New York a couple days ago, it was a Saturday Night Live theme.
Yeah.
So every player on the team and in the traveling party has a Saturday Night Live themed costume. And some of them were really good.
Yes.
Actually, a lot of them were really good. There's one I can't figure out still. I don't know who Steven Souza Jr. was. Jarrett, did you ever find out? Jarrett, between me and Jarrett, I think we have a firm grasp of the history of Saturday Night Live.
Yes, you do.
And neither one of us can figure out who he's supposed to be.
Really?
Yeah. Have you seen what he was wearing?
No, I haven't. I've seen most of them. I love T.J. McFarlane and Zach Godley being the super fans. Da Bears, right? That was pretty good.
Tori Lavello, Blues Brother.
Yeah, that was cool. What else did I think was really? The Wayne and Garth, which was Daniel Descalso and somebody.
Yes.
And so those are pretty good, but I keep seeing this and I wonder about this. And the whole thing about the guys from Blue Oyster Cult, that's outstanding. Patrick Corbin, Paul Goldschmidt, Chris Owings, and Nick Ahmed.
That one was my favorite.
Swayze and Farley in the Chippendale sketch. That's great, too.
Yeah.
And who was dressed up in that? Can you tell?
I can't
tell. The group photo is pretty small.
Yeah, I just retweeted it.
Right. And we can't quite tell you who John Ryan Murphy and Archie Bradley were, but that's okay. You can figure that out on your own. See, in Major League Baseball, they do these things, and it's funny because all professional sports teams like to say road trips, treat them like business trips. Baseball teams do this for what? What is the reason? Is it team bonding? It's a great song, by the way. Oh, I love these guys. Blue Oyster Cult.
The reason why I'm playing this is because Paul Goldschmidt, as you mentioned, was part of the Blue Oyster Cult thing, which is one of the funniest sketches in Saturday Night Live history. Would you agree?
I do agree.
And he's the cowbell guy. He's the Will Ferrell guy.
Uh-huh.
Gene. That might be the best costume of all.
Yeah.
Paul Goldschmidt might need more cowbell to break out of this slump.
Well, he needs something, Vinny. He needs something. So do you think that this serves a purpose, and why don't other sports teams do this when they go on the road?
Baseball teams spend so much time on the road.
Yeah.
I don't think basketball players, and I don't mean this as a knock, but they are so in tune with fashion for the most part.
Because they're all their own brands.
And I don't think they want to risk that at all.
No. I agree.
I think this kind of stuff is great for team chemistry. I mean, you would not be able to tell from the smiles in these photos that they posed for that the Diamondbacks are playing really, really poorly.
No, that's very, very true. And hopefully, they're going to New York. Hopefully this will produce something, especially with Paul Goldschmidt, because there are some serious matters with this baseball team. And you laid a few out yesterday that if Chase Field has become something of a liability or the enemy or uncomfortable for some of these guys, then this road trip is a good litmus test for them to break out of this offensive funk that they happen to be in. Primarily Paul Goldschmidt. We've been saying for a couple of days now that this baseball team, they need him to step up and be a star, not just for the on-field results, but just for what it will do for the entire organization.
Mm-hmm.
If that clubhouse could show up every day to play games knowing that Goldschmidt was back to being who he was, I think it's going to lift everything up, Vinny. I think there's a lot of things at play here. There's Paul Goldschmidt and his sagging confidence and what that means to him. There's the confidence of the opposing pitcher now that Goldie is struggling and looks the part at home plate and how that must help the opponents. All of this. There's the pressure involved. There's the injuries. There's a lineup that really, I mean, you can't go the entire season having Daniel Descalso and A.J. Pollock carry your offense. And now we know A.J. Pollock's going to be gone for a while.
Yes. So it can't be just Daniel Descalso. Now,
yeah.
Jake Lamb could be back this weekend, should be back this weekend, judging from all things. But it's still a tough stretch. And yesterday, earlier, you know, this month, you had kind of, actually going back to last month, you had identified May 13th as the date. All right, that's when we're going to know what the Arizona Diamondbacks are. By no fault of your own, the script kind of got flipped on all that because of the injuries and the team going into a prolonged slump. So I think at the end of this road trip, the 27th, 2 weeks later, when they come back from Oakland, we're going to have a good idea of who they are.
Yep.
Derek Hall, president and CEO of the Diamondbacks, was talking about yesterday with Doug and Wolf, this difficult stretch that they're still mired in, the Diamondbacks.
They showed us what a good team they are, and we know that. You know, this is a team that is, you know, constantly at the top of their division. And when Zach Greinke finishes pitching against them and gives us our solo win there for a week straight, and says, that's one of the toughest lineups I've ever had to navigate through, that tells you something. That's a very good team. But that's where we've been, to have to, you know, go to L.A. and play those, you know, two games and come right back and play four against the Nationals when they got their act together, because they went through what we're going through now. They snapped out of it. And then to have to play the Brewers and then go to New York and then back to Milwaukee, that's tough, and we're going to get through this, and I know we are. We're going to come out on the other side much better.
And that, of course, started with Derek Hall referring to the Brewers, who the Diamondbacks will see in the middle three games of this road trip.
Yeah.
If you look at the pitching matchups that the Diamondbacks will face, they have gone through a string of playing against really, really accomplished pitchers. It's not as daunting on this trip. Two of the first three games, yes. DeGrom, Syndergaard. The Brewers matchups, Anderson, Chacín, and Suter are scheduled to go. But they're also going to get, in the first game Friday, probably Sean Manaea of Oakland. Mm-hmm. He's got a no-hitter against Boston, who has the best lineup in baseball.
Right.
So it's still not easy sledding, but nothing's been easy for this team.
No, and I agree with that. And one of the things, points I made in my most recent column on ArizonaSports.com is the Diamondbacks have a weird duality happening here. Number one, in the National League West, there's not a lot of gripping going on from teams that are coming up fast in the rearview mirror. The Dodgers are still a mess. The Rockies, who really is going to threaten the Diamondbacks if they get their act together? That should give the Diamondbacks at least some comfort zone. But I think locally, we can all feel everything beginning to change. And let me lay this out here for you. Last year when the Diamondbacks brought in this new regime, look around the valley and what did we have? We had a football team in the Cardinals that was entering their last season with Carson Palmer, and that didn't go well. The Suns not making the playoffs. The Coyotes not making the playoffs. The Diamondbacks have this really, really good season that created a lot of great vibes with J.D. Martinez coming in and doing historic things, Archie Bradley becoming a Valley star, that one-game playoff against the Rockies that was just one of those great scrapbook memories for Valley sports fans, and then they lost to the Dodgers. Okay, fine. They pick up this year, and throughout the start of the season, until about the end of April, they had picked up where they had left off, and their continued penchant for winning series added credibility and respect to them, and people were really into this team, and we saw a lot of anecdotal evidence about that. It all changed on April 26th, the night of the NFL draft, when we sat here and Josh Rosen fell to the Cardinals. Everything changed there. On May 15th, the Suns won the NBA draft lottery, and now we have these two future stars coming to Arizona. At that point, Josh Rosen and an undetermined player who's going to be coming to the Suns. But he's a number one pick, so it's created an amazing amount of excitement.
Worst case scenario is there'll be a lot of buzz for 2 years.
That's right.
Even if he's a bust.
That's right. Now, in between that, and I don't know if there's any cause and effect here, and I'm quite certain there's not, but on May 9th, they came to an agreement with Maricopa County that there was going to be no more lawsuits and all that. But part of that deal was the Diamondbacks now were free to look for other homes. And whether you want to call it karma or superstition or whatever, the Diamondbacks have been struggling ever since. And their home field has become once again an issue, not because the Diamondbacks might be leaving, but the whole humidor. What effect is it having? Was it a bad idea to do this? Because keep in mind, last year when there was no humidor, the strength of this team was the pitching staff, and the offense was good enough, but they lost J.D. Martinez. So bringing in the humidor fortified a strength that maybe didn't need it and marginalized an offense that was trying to cope from the loss of a true impact player. Now, that's water under the bridge. You can't change that. But it brings back this idea, and it's not a good one for me, that Chase Field for a while was this, okay, we've turned it around. This is our home field. This is where we rock and roll, and fans started to catch that vibe. And one of the things we kept saying was this new era of fan, of attendance figures that were coming to Chase Field, at least they were a little more engaged. Mm-hmm. The struggles at home, particularly offensively, clearly has muted some of that. Now, when you juxtapose it to what the Cardinals and Suns have created in terms of optimism, this is kind of a thorny time for the D-backs because when you meet people, what do they want to talk about? Josh Rosen or the Suns?
Right now, yeah.
That's okay. And it's coinciding with
or
the Diamondbacks.
Yanni or Laurel.
Or Yanni or Laurel.
Green Needle and Brainstorm.
Exactly. But it's coinciding with the slump from the Diamondbacks. And you know how this town works. It's all ebb and flow. Who's the hot team? Where's the hot party?
Yep.
And so the Diamondbacks now are going to have to struggle to get back what they held for the better part of a year and a month.
Yeah, and I've admitted this to you before, and anybody who listens on a regular basis knows this. Especially during baseball season, I ride the emotional roller coaster. I'm pretty reactionary when it comes to the Diamondbacks. Try not to be, but it's hard for me not to. At this point, yes. Is there concern? Certainly. This has been like a month and a half of lackluster, less than Diamondback offensive baseball. But do I feel good about things still? Yes, and let me explain why, and you hit on it. The rest of the National League West doesn't appear to be primed to take this next step to take over this division. And even with all of the Diamondbacks' warts, they're still probably the best team. The Dodgers got Justin Turner back, and he's hit the cover off the baseball so far. He's had hits in all three games. He had a 5 RBI game last night, and they finally broke their losing streak. Is Justin Turner enough for now to right the ship for the Dodgers? I don't know. That's a team with a lot of issues, and Clayton Kershaw's still out.
Yeah.
SI.com had their quarter point of the season roundtable with all their baseball writers, and they asked questions and had responses from all of them. What team is in legitimate trouble? Tom Verducci, one of the most respected names in baseball, says the Dodgers. He writes, Clayton Kershaw is a question until he's actually back throwing competitive pitches. Seager's gone for the year. Puig has been awful. The bullpen is the third worst in the league. And the hidden trouble with this team is in its defense. Dodgers have gone from the best defensive team last year to one of the worst this year. They need to play about 600 baseball to get to 88 wins. Not happening with the way they look. Others, same question. Emma Bachelieri, easy for me to say. Dodgers are such an obvious choice here. John Taylor, there's no other answers but the Dodgers, is there? Then there was another question. What team is a mirage? And a common response from this panel, Colorado Rockies. Verducci said their offense isn't just good enough. Rockies are last in OPS+. Their rotation is mediocre. John Taylor, he writes, I'm tempted to say every team in the National League West has all the would-be contenders there can't hit or being torn up by injuries. Jack Dickey says the Rockies. Lorenzo Arguello, Rockies. Makes you feel better about the Diamondbacks, well, who have major flaws right now, but are still in better shape than the teams behind them.
No, there's no doubt about it. And I think what we're looking at right now, Vinny, is in Los Angeles, there's a big debate going on about what the Dodgers should do about this. Do you throw a lot of money? Do you get involved in Manny Machado trade talks? Or do you just kind of just not wave the white flag, but just play it out and save your money and regroup next year? That's where they're at in Los Angeles. What it says about the Diamondbacks is there is a great opportunity here to capitalize on the fact that all these other teams are vulnerable and or struggling. But can they do that? And it's fascinating to me because the Machado thing is out there. The latest reports are there's one team right now that seems to be gearing up to make him the trade deadline acquisition, and that's the Cubs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it's all about the Dodgers. Do they get real desperate? Do they look at this division and go, yeah, we can go 70-49 if we bring in a couple of key pieces and get Kershaw back? I don't know. I don't see it. They're 17-26.
Yeah, they've dug themselves a hole, and there's no doubt.
And they've lost a couple of series to really bad baseball teams.
But that being said, if you want to focus in on the Machado thing, and a major theme in that SI roundtable was why the Orioles have not traded Manny Machado yet is a mystery to all of them. They're going nowhere, and the list of teams right now that's interested in Manny Machado, because it's still so early in the season,
yep,
has got to be bigger now. So if you're a Diamondbacks fan, I know Machado could be on their radar, especially with a struggling offense. I think that's still somewhat a pipe dream.
Yep.
But you're kind of hoping, all right, Baltimore, stick by your guns.
Yeah.
Don't trade him until the end of July.
That's right.
Get what you get, because if they trade him in mid to late May to the Dodgers, that could be the determining factor in finally shifting the power of the NL West.
Yeah.
With the Diamondbacks not playing great and the Dodgers getting a boost like that, that could be what sways things.
Yeah. And I would also say that, and you'd have to understand, if you were inside the Diamondbacks facility, this is the only team in Arizona that has a major professional sports championship, okay? Yet at the same time, they've really lived a roller coaster existence. They've either been good or really, really bad. And they've had a couple of times in their existence where they've really lost credibility, been ridiculed locally and nationally. They had this town for a while based on what they did last year. And if they feel that slipping away, that's pressure too. That's pressure outside of the competitive standings. Now, I made the point, and I heard this from somebody, and it makes too much sense to even happen. In the future, you know what would be a great solution for the Diamondbacks, Chase Field, and everything that might happen going forward? The Phoenix Rising, the soccer franchise, they have to put together an MLS bid because that's huge to their survival. They are occupying a primo spot of land right off the 202 near the 101, or 101 near the 202, whatever it is. And it was explained to me that, hey, why don't they just kind of trade places? And I thought, bring the soccer franchise downtown, allow them to anchor their MLS bid to Chase Field or the land, and let the Diamondbacks go and build that quaint stadium out there where they are. Because, again, you talk about accessibility. Where that soccer team is just ideal. And if the Diamondbacks want to get out of this big, hulking stadium that, again, has been occasionally a nuisance to them, this would be a good option. It's something to consider going forward. In the short term, they've got to find a way to just stay in first place and rectify these problems, not just because they've got this great opportunity in a very vulnerable division, but they've got this incredible hysteria going around on these two competitors in town here. One, the Suns, who are the heritage franchise, but haven't been to the playoffs in nearly a decade, and the other, the Cardinals, who took over the Valley right when Wisenhunt, Warner, and the Super Bowl run happened and hit a little lull and now suddenly have a franchise quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
Water cooler debate. Civic temperature will all tell you that in the last couple of weeks, the Diamondbacks have sagged where the Cardinals and the Suns have artificially risen based
on... Great point you made.
Based on this stuff.
Yeah, based on... Well, at least on the Cardinals and Suns based on non-game results.
Yeah.
Going back to the location of arenas and venues and all that stuff. I heard Burns and Gambo talking about this when the deal with Maricopa County and the Diamondbacks was finalized, and the Diamondbacks now have the opportunity to go out and seek other locations for a stadium. And Gambo said something, and I don't believe he had data to back this up. It was probably anecdotal and personal to his experience. But in the people that he talked to, and people will bring up, okay, if the Diamondbacks move out to the East Valley, whether it's on Native American land or to the location you said,
right?
What would that do to the West Valley fan base? And Gambo said, now all the people I talked to that live in the West Valley said it wouldn't take any longer to get from the same amount of time to get from the West Valley to downtown as it would around the 101. To get to a Scottsdale location.
Right.
Does it seem to you, Bic, that West Valley residents, if this is at all true, West Valley residents are much more amenable to driving to support a team than East Valley residents are, who make the same complaints about, especially the Coyotes being in Glendale.
Which is maybe why they ended up in the West Valley in the first place, for whatever reasons. Cheaper housing, you sacrifice the longer drive and all that. Maybe they're more conditioned to spend that time in their car. Yeah, I agree with that. And I also think in the situation here, if this whole legalized sports gaming thing happens and it comes to Arizona, what does that do to the Native American tribes that run casinos? Is it going to influence their profitability? Is it going to negatively influence how much money they make and thereby diminish how eager they would be to now get involved with another stadium with a team like the Diamondbacks? I don't know. I don't know the answers to this. There are people who think this legalized gambling thing is going to just rule the world. And when you step back and think about it, I ran this example by you the other day. Say you and I went for post-show beers, which we do on occasion. And we sat down and you could wager in any tavern.
You said post-show, not pre-show.
Right, exactly. And we sat down and we were hanging out. Maybe we were bored. Maybe a game was coming on. And, hey, let's put some money on this game. You're going to sit there and watch the game based on it. And then that is going to create probably patterns of habit. You can see where this might become a really big deal with a lot of money to be made.
There's definitely money to be made.
Yeah. And so how is that going to affect all of this? I mean, if stadiums now are going to be able to offer gambling right there when you walk in, is that going to increase attendance? I would think so. I think there's going to be a lot of wrangling and fighting over just who's going to be able to do this. And because there's going to be a lot of money to be made. But as the corollary, I just don't know what it's going to do towards Native American tribes to sink money into sports stadiums if legalized sports gambling decreases the amount of people who like to go to casinos. I don't know if it will, because I don't gamble.
I think they're unrelated, don't you think?
Well, that's my question. Are they?
Well,
yes.
Can they get involved in the legal sports gambling? I mean, that's a huge possible revenue stream for them as well.
But that's exactly right, too. And wouldn't there be a battle about that? Because if the city of Phoenix wants to get involved in this for their general fund to pay teachers, then they're not going to want to share all of this. I think there's going to be a lot of wrangling coming up about who can do this, where can they do this, all of that. And we don't even know if Phoenix is going to do it, but Doug Ducey sounds like he wants to. All of this is
Mark Brnovich sounds like he wants to as well.
Well, yeah. And I mean, to me, a great solution is, like I said, move the soccer team, give them the land where America West Arena is on, let them play there.
West Arena.
I'm sorry, Talking Stick Resort Arena.
I'm You're lost like two in the past, sponsors
dude.
Behind.
Lost in the past, dude.
Let the Give Suns, them the madhouse on
let
McDowell.
Let the Suns go across the street to that bigger footprint where Chase Field is. Let them build that gigantic stadium where they can get 15 semis to, you know, bring in the big musical acts, and then let the baseball team go someplace where they can build a stadium that just feels like baseball, for what it's worth.
But will it ever truly feel, to tie a bow on it, will it ever truly feel like baseball in a dome?
I don't know. Probably
Which
not.
Is, you can't avoid it.
Unless you can create a dome that actually allows ambient light to come in, or just something that kind of doesn't make you feel like you're stuck in an airplane hangar.
What about an open air stadium with just like really, really good air conditioning?
Or a really
screw
good
screw you environment,
right? Or a really good stadium with these really cool shading techniques. I just don't know if you can do that in Phoenix. I've seen drawings of like stadiums in Florida where they use like things that look like sails, canvas sails from ships, and they place them over the top of the stadium and they just shade the sun.
Yeah,
but the temperatures here are what's so foreboding.
Well, and people will say, "Oh, you play at night anyway during the summer." Yes, that's true. But anybody who grew up in Phoenix and used to go watch the Phoenix Giants or Phoenix Firebirds out in PCL play at night, it was still miserable.
It could still be almost 100 degrees at night in the summer,
or hotter.
What a miserable place we live.
Sanderson Ford and Presidential Pools are teaming up for the 10K carpool giveaway. You can win 10 grand towards the purchase of a Sanderson Ford or a Presidential Pool, or you can pocket the cash. All you have to do is text carpool to 620-620 or go online to carpoolgiveaway.com. That's carpool. Text it to 620-620. 6:20. Well, a story in the NFL that's developing. It looks like redemption for one player in the NFC West. We'll tell you about it more about it next. Bickley and Murata, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station. Happy Friday. Bickley and Murata here from the Auction Community Studios on 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station. If you haven't done it yet, download the Arizona Sports app. That way you take the whole radio station and website with you wherever you go. You can listen live. You get access to podcasts. You can also access all of our content. Great content on arizonasports.com. Never a bad time to download the arizonasports.com app. This is not a fun story we're going to get into here, Bick, but I think it needs to be talked about.
Mm-hmm.
On February 11th, there was an incident allegedly involving San Francisco 49ers linebacker Reuben Foster. His ex-girlfriend, Alyssa Ennis, claimed that Foster hit her 8 to 10 times, dragged her out of his house, threw her to the ground, and spit on her in a domestic altercation. She also alleged that the linebacker broke her phone and threw their dog at her. Among the injuries Ennis suffered was a ruptured eardrum that required a hospital visit later in the day. Immediate reaction, not saying it's an incorrect reaction. The 49ers said, look, if this is true, he's done. He's done as a 49er. And there's that whole public outcry. We live in different times when it comes to domestic violence, and I think that's a good thing. Alyssa Ennis was on the stand in San Jose, California, and testified that she lied a lot to authorities about an alleged domestic violence incident. She said while she was under oath, quote, I was pissed and I wanted to end him. I'm sorry, I really am. I apologize to everybody. She also admitted to falsely accusing a former boyfriend of domestic violence in Louisiana after he attempted to break up with her.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Domestic violence, whether it's a woman against a man against a woman, children involved, man on man, woman on woman, however the violence breaks down, it's one of the worst things you can do to another person. One tiny little tick down on the disgusting scale is falsely accusing somebody of doing that to you because of what I just described. And that is the feeling in America, which is the correct feeling to have, that this needs to be snuffed out. And, you know, once you're accused of this, you're branded a certain way by society. And to do this knowingly more than once, A, is reprehensible. And what this Alyssa Ennis does is also diminish the perceived validity of a lot of women claiming domestic violence against against people.
Right.
She just weakened women's cases by doing this because of spite and because she didn't want to get broken up with. And she's done it twice to two different guys.
Right.
That's disgusting. She should be thrown in jail.
Yes. There are other possibilities here, Vinny. And again, I'm just, since we're looking at this from that angle, there's also the option of a woman with very credible complaints suddenly being paid off to change her tune by the person she's accusing.
She admitted to everything.
Okay.
Remember the scene in the Goonies where Chunk admits to all the bad stuff he's done?
Yeah.
She got on the stand and she admitted to stealing more than $8,000 from Foster after taking his account and routing numbers.
Well, that's pretty bad.
Yeah. This
Reuben Foster is not a good dude. We all know that. But I hear what you're saying. And the danger of it is it's twofold. Number one, it plays into a time and a space in this country where, like you said, now you are stigmatized. Now you're among the worst of the worst. To prey on that movement, which is very good, by the way, because domestic violence is vile. To prey on that movement, like you said, is one tick below or maybe even above. Look, given the circumstances,
it's reprehensible in every way.
It really, really is. Yeah, I'm with you on that. But Reuben Foster, to be clear, is not a good dude. And we know that. And there's, I'm just throwing this out there because,
but even if you're not a good dude, you don't deserve this.
I agree with that.
And there's no excuse for it.
Okay, when you look at Ray Rice and what he did, and that video in that elevator is what changed the conversation for everybody.
Absolutely.
And which is pretty ridiculous when you think about it, because until people could see what domestic violence looked like on a grainy videotape, did you have a hard time putting it together before that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
people did apparently,
including
Roger Goodell in the NFL.
You can say that again. You look at Ray Rice and how he responded to that. I mean, by all accounts, he handled it really with a degree of nobility. He and his wife are, you know, happy. He was remorseful. He did all the right things, and yet he never got a chance to play football again. So instead of becoming a shining light for if you are someone prone to this, how to own it and change yourself, he became ostracized.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation, you're right. I think this has really come to the forefront in sports. And along that line, not just domestic violence, but just all the inappropriate actions that powerful, rich men have taken in terms of liberties with females, the Me Too movement. Okay. We have seen this culture really prevalent in college athletics, where young star football players and basketball players, either through feeling entitled or never getting in trouble for their actions or ever being held accountable in the past, feel like I can do this because everything's mine. And I agree with you. In this situation, this diminishes the severity in which people will look at this because, oh, really? Is she just making that up? See what happened to Reuben Foster? Mm-hmm. I agree with you. It's not a good situation at all.
All right, elsewhere in football, Terrell Owens has been out of the game for a while. He's still training to make a comeback. He's 44 years old, wants mm-hmm. to play. I don't think he'll ever get that chance, obviously. But he went on a radio station, 105.3 The Fan in Dallas. He had some pretty pointed things to say about Jason Garrett, the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys.
When you really look at it, it doesn't make sense for Jason Garrett to continue to have his job, not really making any, not really expanding or not really progressing with the organization, even as a team, under his coaching tenure there.
T.O. went on to implore the owner, Jerry Jones, to take action.
It all boils down to players being the scapegoat for his inability to lead the team as he should. For me, it's mind-boggling. I don't understand it. And I think Jerry, again, he's the owner. At the end of the day, he has to feel good with himself about the decisions. But I just don't understand why this guy still has a job.
During the interview, he also brought up the Dwayne Casey example. He said Casey was voted unanimous coach of the year, has taken Toronto to the playoffs. Do we have that cut? I didn't quite see that. Oh, there it is. I'll just let him say it.
You look at let's bring up basketball for a second. Here you have Dwayne Casey of the Toronto Raptors.
Yeah.
This guy voted unanimous, you know, coach of the year, has taken Toronto to the playoffs, three straight years or whatever, had three straight years of winning 50-plus games, and then they don't make it, you know, beyond where they what the expectations are within their organization. And he gets fired. And then you have Jason Garrett, who has no accomplishments, not even close to that. And he continues to still have a job.
Normally, I'll listen to what T.O. says, and I'll roll my eyes, and I'll get on with mm-hmm. my day. This one made me think a little bit. Jason Garrett does have an awful lot of job security.
Oh, yeah.
He's going into his ninth year as the head coach of the Cowboys. They've had two really good seasons, 12-4 in 2014. Where they won one playoff game. 2016, they went 13-3. They didn't win a playoff game. He's got one playoff win in 8 years and three winning seasons. Three 500 seasons.
Uh-huh.
And a terrible losing season.
Uh-huh.
Are you surprised that he still has a job?
No, because Jerry Jones is kind of like what we've always been talking about when it comes to Robert Sarver. What kind of guys has Jerry Jones liked to hire as a head coach? Put in Wade Phillips. Put in Jason Garrett.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get along with Jimmy Johnson, who was a great football coach.
Couldn't get along with Bill Parcells.
He does not want that big profile, autonomy-craving head coach who's going to tell the owner, stop talking to the media, stop having your own press conference every Sunday, stop coming down to the sideline at the end of the game, stop telling our players and meeting with our players to orchestrate an anthem display, which, by the way, I don't know if you heard the details about that. So when Jerry Jones went into that locker room in Glendale before they did what they did, he laid it out to his team, and then he left. Apparently, one assistant coach went nuts, and he went up to Jason Garrett. He said, whatever freaking happened to blocking out all the noise? Why are we even focusing on this? Why can't our guys just focus on their jobs and what they have to do against the Cardinals? This was going on from an assistant to Jason Garrett. But Jason Garrett is the head coach because...
He's a yes man.
Because he would never go to Jerry Jones and go, Jarrah, can you back up a little bit?
Well, in hindsight, all the histrionics and demonstrations and thinking that went into that for the Cowboys didn't hurt them. They still beat the Cardinals. Ouch. Coming up, hero ball. Is that the way for the Cavs to go to get back into their series with the Boston Celtics? One player doesn't think so. We'll tell you about it next. Bickley and Murata, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.
Floor Burns with Bickley and Murata.
Yeah, we have to ramp it up. We're playing too slow. We're making Bron play hero ball, which is tough to do, especially in the Eastern Conference Finals. We gotta help him. And with that said, we have to give him an opportunity for us to make him feel confident to give us the ball so we can make the right plays. So we got to help him and he got to help us.
J.R. Smith of the Cleveland Cavaliers heading into Game 3 of the Eastern Conference Finals in Cleveland tomorrow night. The Cavs are down 0-2. LeBron's had one bad game, one good game. Didn't matter what he did, they're still down 0-2. He's had different levels of support at times in this playoff. The first round against Indiana, not much. Second round, he had quite a bit against Toronto. Not so much so far against Boston. We've been so focused, Bick, on superstars driving what teams are successful in the NBA for so long.
Yeah.
Do you think we're seeing just a case, maybe an outlier case of team trumping superstar? For the
yes.
Because Boston plays team basketball. They don't have an established superstar on the floor for them right now. They got a lot of good, solid players, but they don't have anybody close to LeBron's profile.
No.
Is it just team beating superstar right now?
No, I think so. And I think that you can make an argument, and some people have, that this might be among the worst supporting cast LeBron James has ever had. And he's had a couple of really bad ones early in his career. The big story here is exactly as you outlined. Can a player threatening to be the greatest of all time somehow lift this cast of his against a team playing really good team basketball? Will the Celtics show up in Cleveland ready and primed for a letdown, or do they smell blood and just really continue to smother LeBron James and the Cavaliers? It's a story and a possibility with huge implications, Vinny, because the whole LeBron, where is he going to go? What's he going to do? It's going to become intense if the Cavaliers are summarily swept out of the playoffs. Because when you look at Cleveland, there's not much they can do to improve this team next year. For once, the NBA draft lottery did not work out in their favor. they've made a lot of bad trades. Don't think LeBron James hasn't seen. Did you see what that one dude on the Celtics said about Danny, or the one guy in the Cavaliers called Danny Ainge?
Yeah, you know, apparently he turned to somebody on the bench and he says he's a blanking thief. That was during the season, though, before the Cavs revamped their roster.
Yeah.
So they still had Isaiah Thomas and Jay Crowder and those guys.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of sums up people's feelings on Danny Ainge and what he's been able to do.
And he was speaking about the Kyrie Irving trade, and here we go. So if this thing all just kind of falls apart, it's really going to be a question of when LeBron leaves and not if, in my opinion. And then that's going to be the one of the big hallmarks of the offseason. I don't have a lot of confidence that Cleveland can go in there and do anything against Boston based on what they did against Indianapolis and Toronto. I really don't. And when you think about the pieces that Boston is missing at the time, it's really saying something. But they've played intelligent defense against LeBron. And J.R. Smith has just been a waste, hasn't made a three-point shot in the series.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I told you after game two in Boston, LeBron seemed to take that loss very easily, almost as if he knows, there's nothing I can do about this.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm wrong, but we'll see.
And there's that. There, the lack of support is certainly a talking point. And this is not the first time this has happened in LeBron's career either, that while he's in the midst of a playoff series deep into the playoffs, that everybody's wondering also about his whereabouts for the next season. Is he going to be back in Cleveland?
Oh, yeah.
Is he going to go to L.A.? Brian Windhorst went on Pardon the Interruption earlier this week, and he's, you know, he's got a pipeline to LeBron. He's been almost like a personal reporter for him. Quote, I just cannot see him going to the Western Conference. I can't see it, Windhorst said. Unless it's just like, I want to be happy and live in Los Angeles if he and Paul George go to the Lakers. Unless there's some other move that I can't see and they're competing with the Rockets and Warriors, they may win 47 games and be the fourth seed and then get knocked out in the second round. Maybe he wants to do that. My gut says he still wants to compete for championships, so he's got to stay East. And
yeah.
I totally agree with that.
So then, where in the East?
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia. That would seem to be the number one choice, or... do you go to New York? No. Why would you go to New York if you're not going to compete for championships?
Especially if Kristaps Porzingis isn't going to play for a good portion of next year.
And that's the bottom line here. I do think that is the defining piece, because whether or not LeBron James wants to admit it now, he has admitted it in the past that he's obsessed with catching Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. And he knows to do that, you need to play for more championships. So, yes, I think that's the way you look at it. East and contender. Now that list really narrows. Not going to go back to Miami.
No.
No.
I think it's Philly or maybe going back to Cleveland, which I don't see. It's interesting, too, if you want to look into the crystal ball. Let's say LeBron does stay in the East. He does go to Philly and pairs with Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, and they would be among the favorites in the Eastern Conference for a championship run. I think Boston's going to be stacked next year, too.
Oh, yeah.
But let's say LeBron goes to Philly. They win a championship. Winning a championship for three different teams, and I assume he would still be the focal point of that team, that would do a lot to increase the resume.
Yeah.
If he's truly obsessed with catching Michael Jordan, I mean, to do it with two teams is great. To do it with three,
yeah,
that's unheard of.
Yeah, and Philly is the place to go, and you can only imagine what it must be like in Philadelphia with this run of luck that they have had recently. Could you imagine getting LeBron on top of all of that?
Mm-hmm.
Brian Windhorst also said that LeBron James and the Cavaliers, they have another problem other than a talent issue. They have got organizational fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
They're all sick of each other. They've been together too long, and they've got new faces there, but I'm talking about LeBron and some of the principal pieces, the coaches.
Well, it's all the maintenance that goes along with having LeBron on your roster.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And so all of that is why I don't think there's much hope for the Celtics, or I'm sorry, for the Cavaliers in this. The only thing that that would be there for them is if the Celtics have a relaxed game. If they show up in game three without the intensity that teams need to win this time of year, which happens all the time. And it boggles coaches' minds how players can do it, but it's just human nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're up 2-0 against a team that you've smothered a couple of times and you think, we got this, you know?
Yeah.
And then you roll into Cleveland, you've had a few days off, and you just don't have that same edge, you know? So here we go. This offseason is going to be crazy, but all these NBA offseasons have been crazy. LeBron James might be moving. Kawhi Leonard probably moving. Two big names to be changing
teams.
Forget
about DeMarcus Cousins because he's
DeMarcus
been out for so
Cousins,
long.
Yeah.
He could be moving.
DeMarcus Cousins,
Paul
who
George
just
could be moving.
Who just deleted the Pelicans from his Instagram account. What is he trying to say? He took a page out of LeBron's passive aggressive playbook.
He wrote the book, and there's a lot of people reading it.
That's right. That's right.
All right. It is the Friday edition of Bickley and Murata. The Bickley Blast coming up next here from the Ak-Chin Community Studios, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.